Boy, it's a classic from Rich Mullins, but it's timeless. Are you ready for the storm? 11 and a half minutes past the hour on a Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning. I'm Jim Park. David Allen Punt is there in the newsroom looking very attentive. And the reason is we're joined by Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. Doug is kind enough to join us just about every Wednesday morning and enlighten us, typically with the context of Scripture. And we'll get into that some today, too. But, Doug, I have to ask, I know that you do frequent tours, annual tours to Israel. And, of course, now Pauline studies tours, too, to Italy. So you're a well-traveled guy. Israel is in the news, not in a happy way this morning. What's your take on all that going on over there? The rockets, the violence, the deaths? What's happening?
Well, I was first went to Israel in 1988. That was the first Intifada. And then they threw rocks at you. And I remember distinctly as we drove south from the Sea of Galilee down to Masada in the Dead Sea region. We went through whatever it was, 80 miles of the Palestinian Authority land, the West Bank land. And as we approached Jericho, we all ducked down in the bus in case there were going to be rocks thrown at us. We were driving in an Arab bus. That was one of the precautions that we took. And I don't think we ever saw a rock thrown our way, but, you know, that was the concern back in the late 80s. I simply point that out to make an observation that periodically the pressures build up and the pressures blow. And there's been a cycle of that. You can see it through time. And after this, the blow takes place, the safety valve sort of gets released and things quiet down for a while until the next time they tend to blow again. And these days, of course, they don't throw rocks. They're shooting small rockets out of Gaza to some of the southern cities. Some of the longer range ones are get to the edge of Tel Aviv. But the first perspective that I have is that periodically the pressure blows, and then it quiets down for a while, and you know pretty much where it's going to blow, so you avoid those areas. For example, these days, if I had I would leave tomorrow, by the way, on another study program to Israel. It's not on the calendar for tomorrow, but if it was, I would go. And we would not go south. We would not go to the Beersheba region because that's where the rockets from Gaza generally are targeted. And we would never be in Jerusalem on Friday afternoon, which is when all the young men come out of the mosque after being worked up by their imams and start throwing rocks at the Israeli police. I mean, you just know that. You're going to be careful when you go to the south, and you're going to not be in Jerusalem on Friday afternoon. Everywhere else in the country, it's absolutely quiet and peaceful, and you're perfectly safe. Now, I want to try to make a point here that I'm sure David is going to jump on favorably, but let me make it by way of analogy here, because I'm in my car, and we have a car that gave us Sirius XM radio, you know, for a year or something like that when we bought it. So I'm listening to CNN at 4 o'clock. This is probably 3, 4, 5 days ago now. And the lead story is, I forget who the CNN correspondent was in Jerusalem, saying that the young man had been found burned, the 15-year-old Palestinian boy, and they felt that was in retaliation for the death of the three teenagers down near Hebron. And here's the header: Israel on the verge of war. And I said to myself, that's simply not true. That is sensationalistic reporting. And one of the things you need to do is you need to factor that into your thinking. Now, it is an ultimate tragedy when teenagers die. I'm not going to take anything away from that. But to conclude that because of that happened, that Israel is on the verge of war, is just a vast overstatement. Let me try to get here another way. I just heard 2 days ago that on the Sunday of July 4th weekend, in Chicago, 12 people were murdered, okay, in one day. If CNN did equal treatment to what happens in Israel with what happens in Chicago, the corresponding headline would be 12 people murdered, state of Illinois on the verge of civil war. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's an analogous headline treatment there. About 2 or 3 years ago, actually, when John Delancey had a study group in Israel, there was another flare-up again, I think because a couple of rockets came south out of southern Lebanon into the Israel airspace. Christiane Amanpour was on the streets of Tel Aviv doing a live report back that said, this city is on edge. It is palpable, the tension here, the fear. And it went on and on and on. And John Delancey was watching this broadcast live on one of the major commercial thoroughfares of Tel Aviv. And he glanced up and down the street, and all the cafes were filled, and everyone was having a good time. And the normal chit-chat chatter and people walking on the sidewalks and looking in the store windows was the same as always. You get the idea here? Mm-hmm. Is that you have to, for whatever reason, they have to sensationalize the news. They have a certain bias in their reporting. You know, I know people think that the media is biased here in the United States when it comes to political reality. There's a bias to the media when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian issue as well. And so my first reaction is, this is another blow up. This is the pressure builds up, and it blows like it threw a safety valve. And in 3 or 4 months from now, it will be quiet again, maybe even in 6 weeks, and life will go on. And believe me, Doug Greenwald feels far more safer in Israel today than I would in Chicago, and that I would in Southeast Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. So it's all a question of perspective. It's a question of understanding the biases that are at work. The fellow that I team teach with in Israel, Dr. Randy Smith, used to be a CNN video correspondent about 25 years ago, and actually was filming the stuff that was going on in the first Lebanese war. And every day he would film footage, and he would they would sneak it out of Lebanon. He was in Lebanon at the time, and it would get to Washington, D.C. And then he would watch 2 days later at his how his video footage was treated and how the broadcast was put together, and realize that what was being reported on from what he sent bore no resemblance to what he captured on film and reported back to headquarters. And so after several months of that, he quit CNN because of, let's just call it, a bias that way. So, I mean, that's how I react to what's going on. It certainly is tragic every time someone loses a life, and lives have been lost on an ongoing basis in that conflict. There is no question about that. But that is a different issue than asserting that Israel is on the verge of war.
And yeah, if you get past the headlines, and I read deeper into the BBC story this morning, and it's all filled with bombast and excitement and armed to the teeth, and people are on the edge. And then there's a picture of a group of looked like Hasidic students sitting on the edge of a building watching the war, and they're pointing at it. See, look, there's one over there. I mean, see that open air, open field? There's a bomb that exploded over there. So those guys are not feeling in any danger. And then if you read down at the bottom of the BBC story, it says that there were 12 Palestinian militants killed. 12? That's it? 12? Yeah, I feel like, you know, from all the excitement that you started out the story with, you should have been certainly a lot more than 12. Back in the ancient days, I used to teach, or I designed and taught a course in broadcast writing and broadcast journalism to freshmen and sophomores in college on ASU. And I usually start out the class by saying, what's the most important element in any news story? And somebody would say, well, it's got to be about somebody big and powerful. It's got to be about something that's going to change the world. It's got to be something like that. And I said, Does anybody care about truth? And everybody says, oh, yeah, that's it. Truth, truth. It's got to be about truth. It's got to be true. It's got to be. That's the most important part. And I said, none of the above. I says, the most important part for you is you've got to get people's attention. Because if you don't, the boss will find somebody else to fill your job. That's the most important part. Now, concentrate on getting attention. Make noise. Be truthful. Be accurate, but make noise and make it sound much worse than it is. Mm-hmm. And that's the secret.
Hype it, spin it.
So you know, we agree, Doug.
We used to have, 8-10 years ago, there was this rash of suicide bombers in Israel. And finally, Israel said, we've had enough of this, and we're going to build a wall. And the outcry from the world, you can't do that, you know. You can't seal these people in. I mean, that whole storyline. But guess what? When that wall was completed, there are no more suicide bombers. Mm. I mean, what people fail to realize here is Israel will do whatever it takes to secure its country. They put up with stuff for a while, and eventually they get to a tipping point and say, okay, enough is enough. And we're going to take action. Whenever they take action, the world, you know, climbs on their case and criticizes them. But you've got to understand, I mean, if you go back to 1948, when the last Brit pulled out of Palestine and the mandate was over, I mean, the world really expected that the Arab legions would just overwhelm these Israelis and that would be the end of this problem. And through a series of miracles, they were able to survive, and now they thrive, and they are not going to let anything happen detrimentally to the benefit of their country. And if they have to take responses from time to time, that's exactly what they're going to do. There should be no surprise about that. Sometimes I'm amazed how long of a fuse they have. But their history is, people expected us to get wiped off the map in 1948, and it didn't happen. And now we've got Hamas trying to still do the same thing today. And at a certain level, nothing's changed at all. Now, before you get deluged with objections or disagreements with what I've just said, you know, I need to balance this off by saying Israel has really made some poor decisions in the past. I mean, there is no question about that, particularly in the early years of the country from 1948 to 1951, 52. I mean, they literally came in and took over lands and olive orchards and fig tree orchards from Palestinians that had been in the Palestinian family for 1,000 years, gave them 24 hours to get out of town. And they took control of it, and that animosity has been there ever since. And after the 67 war, when the West Bank was about one-third Christian, the first cities that the Israeli government targeted with the bulldozers, the Palestinian villages to bulldoze, were those with the highest Christian content. And so now about 3% of the West Bank is Christian, where it used to be 30%. And what the Israeli governments failed to realize is that the Christians were the peacemakers. And when they drove the peacemakers out, somebody else moved into the vacuum, and they're living with the consequences of that today. So tragic and terrible decisions have been made on both sides of this equation. That's part of why it's so deep-seated and why it seemingly seems so intractable.
Interesting observations. Doug, again, senior teaching fellow at Preserving Bible Times. And Doug, you'd mentioned a parable. In fact, you brought it up last week to us. And it has to do with minas and noblemen. And I get the feeling we've been taught something that really isn't there with respect to that parable.
Yeah, you know, ever since I came back from the Italy trip on Pauline Context, and I've been more exposed to the Gentile pagan world of the first century than ever before, it's just caused me to recalibrate my thinking and my way of looking at things. Historically, when I taught the Gospels, I just implicitly assumed that this was mostly a Jewish world. And there were a sprinkling of Gentiles, you know, here and there. And I'm almost about to totally reverse that understanding. You know, just 4 miles north of Nazareth are the remains of a city of 12 to 15,000 people. And it's a Greco-Roman city called Sepphoris. Its other name is Zippori. And it's only 4 miles north of Nazareth. Sepphoris is of interest because we never hear it mentioned in the gospel record, even though it's 4 miles from Nazareth. And it also is of interest because it was almost completely built out of limestone, which meant that they would have needed an awful lot of stonemasons to build this Roman city of 12 or 15,000 people at the time of Jesus. And the root word that has been mistranslated carpenter, or misunderstood as carpenter, really means tradesman. And in this culture, you really couldn't make it the full-time job as a carpenter, just because just about everything is made out of stone. You may have a minor degree in carpentry, but you're going to need a major degree in stone masonry, stone cutting. So, you know, we're pretty much lean to the understanding that Joseph and Jesus were stonemasons and that they very well may have worked for years cutting limestone to be part of this great city called Sepphoris, Gentile pagan city, 4 miles north of Nazareth. Now, as Jews, they never would have entered the city limits of that city, but they would have gotten the dimensions from other people of the stones that needed to be cut, and they would have cut those stones outside the city limits so that they maintained their ritual purity. But it raised the issue in my consciousness. My goodness, there's a city of 12 to 15,000 people that's basically entirely Roman. And so, because the Roman Empire exported its culture uniformly all throughout the world, that which we saw in Pompeii, that which we saw in Herculaneum, that's what we saw in Oplontis, that which we saw in Rome, is going to be in this city, Sepphoris, as well, right there, smack dab in the Galilean region. Then I came to my remembrance, there's Tiberias, which Herod Antipas had built, another city of 15,000, very intensely Greco-Roman with some Hellenistic Jewish overlays to it. That's just 10 or 12 miles south from Capernaum on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, another substantial Greco-Roman city. And then I said to myself, well, of course, there's the Decapolis. That's over in the southeastern quadrant of the Sea of Galilee. And here we have 10 Greco-Roman cities that are all about, just as Rome is, they're fully hedonistic. They're all about pleasure. They're all about polytheism, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The more I thought about it and began to add up the numbers, it appears as if there were more Roman Gentiles, Greco-Roman pagans in Galilee than there were Jewish people. And so, of course, the disciples would have known some things about the Roman world. Of course, they would have been familiar with how that Roman world works, because it's far more pervasive in terms of its reach and coverage, population-wise, in the Galilee district than perhaps even the Jewish cities were. And then I began to think about what I know to be true, that the religious Jews really are only up in the northwest quadrant of the Sea of Galilee in what we call the first century evangelical triangle, and that's Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin. And Capernaum, at its max, might have had 7,500 people in it. Bethsaida, maybe several thousand. And you start adding up the numbers and, you know, you sort of got to recalibrate your mind and say, the Jews are in a minority up here. This is far more a Greco-Roman world in terms of population count and number and in terms of substantially large cities than there is a Jewish population. And so it's caused me to sort of repack my mind or look at it things from a different perspective than I think I have before, strictly because of that trip that we took to Rome to study Pauline context. But I began to see how much of the Roman world context is spilling over into the understanding of Israel in the first century as well. So then when we get to parables, which I never paid attention to before, I mean, I paid attention to the parables, but some of the words in this parable of the 10 mina here, and Jesus says right after, he's in fact, he's probably still with Zacchaeus at Zacchaeus's villa in Jericho. And Jesus says, while they were listening to these things are the conversations that Jesus is having with Zacchaeus, Jesus went on to tell a parable because he was near Jerusalem. And that's true. If he's in Jericho, he's about 18 miles from Jerusalem. He has to go up the Wadi Kilt to get there. And they supposed, they being the disciples, that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately. And this tells us something about the disciples. In their 3 years with Jesus, they still haven't picked up this theme that his kingdom is a future kingdom as well as a present kingdom. And they still are thinking like the rabbis have been declaring that when Messiah comes, he will go straight to the temple and reign in an earthly, political, military manner. And finally, there will be peace, prosperity, and social justice in this land. This phrase here, that the kingdom of God was going to appear immediately, pretty much tells us that that's how Jesus is viewing his disciples and their understanding of things. So he has to try to tell them a story, give them a parable that will get them out of that mindset, to help them understand that he's not going to Jerusalem right now to reign militarily and politically, to set up a new earthly kingdom. He has a heavenly kingdom in view, and actually he's going to leave this earth for a while, and then he's going to return triumphantly. So he draws upon another Greco-Roman example here. When he says, a nobleman, that's Roman talk, went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return. Well, if they're very familiar with the Greco-Roman world and particularly their own history of their part of the world, they know that whenever Rome captures a new country, their preference is to set up a local puppet king, not install one of their own procreators like Pilate, as the best way to subjugate this newly conquered land and to keep them content, or as content as possible. But there are a lot of people in the a new piece of land, a country that had been conquered by Rome, that know that this is Rome's practice. And so there are always contenders about who is going to be the puppet king. And so each pretender sends an entourage to accompany himself to go to Rome to plead his case with the Roman Senate. This is a competitive kind of situation. This is what Herod the Great did in 40 BC when he went to Rome and overtured the Roman Senate to make him king. There were others who likewise went to Rome to say, no, 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 you don't want Herod, you want me. And no, 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 you don't want him or Herod, you want me because I can do this for you. It's very competitive and it's kind of bad to be on the losing side because this is the Middle East and there are reprisals if when the winner is selected, he does not look favorably on his competitors. He does not want them to continue to overture the Roman Senate. And so you want to be very careful who you identify with during this interim period of time when different groups of people leave their native country, sail to Rome, make their overture. You have no idea who's going to win. And so you're sort of in a holding pattern here, waiting for your guy to come back to see did he prevail or did he not. And there's a certain amount of anxiety about being behind, wondering if your guy is going to prevail, because if he doesn't prevail, you are now at risk for reprisals from whoever the Roman Senate did pick. Okay? It turns out that after Herod the Great died, his son Archelaus went to Rome and overtured Rome to allow him to carry on and continue, which Rome did for a couple years. until they found out that he was so bad that they removed him. Okay, so there's this backdrop here when Jesus talks about a nobleman who went to a distant country to receive a kingdom for himself and then return. They know what he's talking about. He's talking about risk and who you identify with in the interim here until the winner becomes clear. Now, the next verse. And then Jesus called 10 of his slaves, and this is when the word slave has now started to jump off the page to me here. In most Bible translations, the word is servants. That's a mistranslation that goes all the way back to the King James translators in 1611, and then has pretty much been sustained in most Bible translations ever since. I think I mentioned last week that John MacArthur was reading a book several years ago about the original understanding of this word slaves and what a Roman slave was all about, and the lights went off in John MacArthur's head, and he realized, and this is his phrase for it, there has been a great cover-up. To cover up this word slave and to substitute the word servant. Because when Paul uses this word slave, he's trying to give the Christians an identity. And MacArthur said that half the books that he has written are about helping people have a Christian identity. And if he had known that this is what Paul intended, that our identity was to be seen as a slave of Christ, it would have saved him half of the books that he's written over his career. So this is a pretty significant understanding here, that doulos, which is the Greek word behind this here, really is translated slaves, not servants. And for past political reasons, which you might be able to envision, people shy away from using the word slaves, and that's probably why the great cover-up has gone on for the better part of 350 years. But as MacArthur says, we have to get back to this original meaning here, the one of slaves, all right? So Paul is using this word, and now Jesus picks it up in the first century. What is the specific contextual understanding of a slave in this Roman world? And a slave is someone who is purchased in a slave market and basically comes into a family, and many of them serve the master whatever the master says. The difference here is that a slave is purchased, he is owned. A servant is hired. We see a lot of servants in Downton Abbey, but they are not owned by whatever that is there, the Earl of the Abbey. Mm-hmm. I forget his name. Okay. But a slave is totally owned by his master. His sole purpose in life is to do what his master wants done. In fact, they become so much an integral part of the family, almost as adopted sons, that slaves have an orientation that says, what can I do to please my master today? What can I do that will give him great pleasure? Those are the thoughts that a Roman slave walks around with, where typically a servant might be in a passive-aggressive behavior mode. Okay, you don't own me, you just hire me, but I'll do what you say. But seldom does a servant proactively think thoughts like, what can I do that will give my master pleasure today? So there's a huge difference here in these two words, slaves and servant. Now, if you were a Roman slave and you were brought into a family, you live with the family, you are treated like the family. And in this world, part of the genius of Rome is they have given slaves aspirational hope. That is, they can buy their freedom. And many of the masters encourage their slaves to be entrepreneurs. In fact, some of the villas that we walk in Pompeii and Herculaneum in the Naples, Italy area, you can actually see two rooms on either side of a center entryway here that have openings to the street. And those are little one-room stores where the slaves conducted business. And so it's very much a part of the Roman slave world that the master encourage his slaves to do business, to be entrepreneurs, to earn money. And in this case, the money they earn, they can keep and they can use it to buy their own freedom. So now that's a backdrop for the 13th verse here. And then the nobleman called 10 of his slaves and gave them 10 minas and said to them, do business with this until I come back. Doing business, having slaves do business, is very, very common. That would have been a very well understood aspect to this culture. Now, notice what Jesus is not saying in this parable. He's not saying, make a profit for me. He's saying, do business with this. Be identified with me. Be in the front room of my villa. People will know it's my villa. People will know you're doing business in my room, okay? Stay identified with me in the marketplace and do business. Have transactions. But very carefully here, I think this is appropriate reading, he doesn't mandate them to make a profit until I come back. Verse 14, but his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. That's the whole Roman backdrop of competitiveness of different groups, different people, different noblemen and their entourages going to Rome saying, let me be king. And the competing entourages saying, no, you don't want him. He's bad. He's this. He's that. And when, verse 15, when he returned after receiving the kingdom, he ordered that these slaves to whom he had given the money be called to him so that he might know what business they had done. Again, it does not say how much money they made. Okay? What business they had done. And the first appeared and saying, Master, your mina has made 10 mina mores. And he says, well done, thou good and faithful servant. I could go on here, but that continues on until he gets to the last servant who hid his mina because my master, I perceived you as being severe, et cetera, et cetera. But I want to stay focused here on this, what business they had done. I'm pretty well convinced now as I put all these contextual pieces back together and understand this slave context from Paul's Roman world, that what Jesus is saying is, after the cross, I'm going to heaven and I'm coming back, and rest assured in this, I will be triumphant. Okay? You do not have to wonder who's going to win. So in the meantime, I want you to transact for me in the marketplaces of life. I want you to be identified with me publicly and with boldness and courage, if that's what it takes, because I will return triumphant and there will be no reprisals against you, and because you are mine and I am taking you to my heaven. So for me, this is a very encouraging passage here, that my call is to be faithful, to be identified with Jesus in the marketplace, and it's up to the Holy Spirit what profit is generated by that as these transactions, as I'm identifying and stand for Christ in the marketplace. And that fits well with the parable of the fields that are white unto harvest. Jesus simply needs laborers. He's going to take care of making the fields white unto harvest. His job is to make a profit, if you will. He just needs people who will stand for him in the marketplace, be identified with him in the marketplace, and do business in his name in the marketplace. And that's my new understanding of this parable.
Now, do you suppose he was addressing specifically his disciples, or was there a larger crowd there at Zacchaeus' place?
Wherever Jesus goes, it's rare that it's only the disciples. Hmm. Because as we talked before, there's always three layers to a discipleship band. There's the inner 12. There's the next 70. Remember when Jesus sent out the 70, two
yes.
by two?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the third tier of people who identify with Jesus but are never going to walk with him very, very closely. So I would suggest to you that Jesus, while he's addressing this to his disciples, because they're the ones that have a misunderstanding here, so might well other the greater concentric rings of his discipling band here have the same misunderstanding. So while he's speaking to the disciples, he knows full well the others are going to overhear it. Equally.
And I see how critical then is the translation that we're reading. I'm reading along with you, but I'm in a New International Version. And it doesn't talk about business, transacting business. It says that, well, verse 15, this is the way it reads in the NIV. He was made king, however, and returned home. Then he sent for the servants to whom he had given the money in order to find out what they had gained with it.
Uh-huh.
So you can see how we're predisposed to believe this is about something else entirely.
Well, if you believe the word is servants and you don't realize the underlying word is slaves, and then you don't understand the context for Roman slaves, what you just read becomes perfectly understandable. I mean, it's misunderstood, but it's understandable why it's misunderstood.
Yeah, I think it's done in good faith, but it's done out of misunderstanding again. Because I frankly swallow your version hook, line, and sinker. That makes great good sense to me.
Well, context usually ties everything together, and in this case, I think this is another example that context is extraordinarily helpful, getting us again closer to the original intended meaning by the Holy Spirit.
Well, not only does it clear it up as to meaning, but it makes it 10 times as powerful.
It really does, and it also says, relax, followers of Jesus Christ. The prophet is not up to you. That's the work of the Holy Spirit. He just needs people to faithfully stand for him, identify with him, witness for him, speak about him in the marketplaces of life.
David?
I'm just trying to think while you guys were talking about profit and loss and all the rest of it. And I can't imagine Robert Crowley, the Earl of Grantham. He's the guy on Downton Abbey. I can't imagine him letting his servants open up a shop in the front office or in the front of the building, because that would be taking away from his profit. I mean, they would be making money for themselves, supposedly, but that would interfere with his profit making. And the other side of it too is, how fitting is it that the slave is his prime motivation for making money is to improve himself and to make himself more valuable, and at one point give the master back all the money that he's invested. That seems to fit much better than the notion of Robert Crowley's butler working away in the basement, you're developing his wine knowledge, but never having the notion that he's going to be ever more than he is right now.
Interesting. A whole new slant on the parable of the minas. You can find it in Luke chapter 19. It's also in Matthew, given a little bit differently in Matthew 25. But take a look at Luke 19, verses 12 through 27 today. And Doug, what version, what translation were you reading from there?
I am reading from the New American Standard.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to have to get one of those. And have they corrected the word from servant
to slave?
Yes,
they have slaves in the passage.
Okay. Mm. Well, now with the background you've given me, with the context, I can pick that up and maybe get a whole lot more out of it. I'll have to latch on, glom onto one of those translations. Doug Greenwald is the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. It is a marvelous resource for your church. In fact, if you ought to call up Doug today and say, come on out to our church in California or Oregon or Texas or Wyoming or Iowa or wherever you happen to be. And he'll bring you a Bible Alive seminar that will just start your congregation in a marvelous direction, excite them tremendously, and impart knowledge to them that they may not get any other way. He's an invaluable source. The website, preservingbibletimes.org, you can link to from our website at brokenroadradio.com. There's a link over on the right-hand side of the homepage there. It's a beautiful website, brand-new website, with lots of pictures from Italy, huh, Doug?
And Israel.
And Israel, too. Be well worth your time. And Doug, as always, we appreciate your visits here on Wednesdays and look forward to the next one. Are you available next week?
I am, guys, and we'll see you then.
Okay. Okay. Well, take good care of yourself. Enjoy the summer. It's turning nice here. Summer's finally arrived here in East Dakota. We're enjoying the sunshine.
Well, we had 96 yesterday, so summer is certainly here.
No, that's too hot. Okay, Doug, take care. We'll see you next week.
Shalom, shalom.
Shalom.